Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We got this hour underway about 10 minutes ago in the latter part of the first hour, Open Lines, talking a little bit about the driving force behind pop culture, politics, and now even the church. Imitation. Monkey see, monkey do. It's very simple, actually. When this dawned on me, suddenly a lot of stuff that I had been thinking about for literally 2 years suddenly coalesced in my mind, and I realized this is what it's really all about. What it's really all about is, you know, we talk about the influence of culture on the church, and we talk about how it is the culture calls for compromise and promises relevance, and then the church says, oh, that sounds nice, and so it compromises, and the church says, oh, by the way, the check is in the mail. You'll be getting your relevance sometime next week. And it never arrives. But the church believes the culture every time it comes and says, oh, by the way, we've got a new deal on relevance. It calls for only one more compromise, and then you will really be relevant. And it never delivers on the promise. What kind of compromise is it calling for? What does the church end up being when it's compromised enough that it has essentially allowed the culture to call the shots for it? That was the heralding call. That was the clarion call of the ecumenical movement about 30 years ago. The culture is in charge. The church is here to listen to what the culture wants and to provide it. That was promised. What was promised there at the very beginning of the ecumenical movement was, if we allow the culture to call the shots for the church, we will not only be relevant, but we will not only bring new people into the church, but we will also unite all of Christianity. 30 years later, has the check ever arrived? Or has the church compromised to the point where it's really indistinguishable from the culture? Oh, case in point. Here's a case in point. What do they call themselves? They call themselves the front lines of evangelical thought. Fuller Theological Seminary. Another example of monkey see, monkey do. Here's the story from the Los Angeles Times from earlier this week. Seminary is reaching out to Muslims. An evangelical school launches an interfaith effort to allay tensions deriving from 9/11. The newest method of church growth. Fuller Theological Seminary is, by the way, the beating heart of the church growth movement. It has been for decades now. The brightest and the best of the church growth movement have either come out of or gone into and then come out of Fuller Theological Seminary. Their newest method of church growth. Guess what it is? No more witnessing. No more proselytizing. That's how the church will grow. No more witnessing. Here it is. One of the nation's leading evangelical Christian seminaries has launched a federally funded project for making peace with Muslims, featuring a proposed code of ethics that rejects offensive statements and about each other's faith. That's fine and good. Affirms a mutual belief in one God and pledges not to proselytize. This is Fuller Theological Seminary's code of ethics for making peace with Muslims. We won't try to convert you. And we will affirm a belief in a mutual God. The $1 million project initiated by the Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena is hailed by both sides as a pioneering attempt to ease continuing conflict, but in an illustration of sharp theological divide, some conservative evangelicals are challenging the ethics code and asserting they do not believe in the same God as Muslims. What? What? But the polls say we do. I just read this yesterday. 56% of us say that we all, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, worship the same God. The culture says we all worship the same God. Fuller Theological Seminary says, monkey see, monkey do. We all worship the same God. And they follow it to its logical conclusion, which is, we're not going to try and proselytize Muslims anymore. Why should we? We all worship the same God. Some conservative Christians decried parts of the proposed ethics code and predicted that it would bring an uproar from the ranks. For Fuller to declare that Christians and Muslims worship the same God would be a radical departure not only from evangelical tradition, but from the tenets of Orthodox Christianity, said John Revell, a spokesman for Southern Baptist Executive Committee. He also questioned whether evangelical Christians who signed the proposed code of ethics violate and compromise their religious obligation to speak the truth in love and spread the good news of Jesus Christ, because the ethics code says, "We won't try and proselytize you, O Muslims." The controversy over whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God recently flared anew when President George W. Bush affirmed a shared belief with Muslims at a London news conference last month. Remember this? He said, "I think we worship the same God." And evangelicals over here on this side of the pond said, "Wait." Fuller's similar assertion is tragic and lamentable, says Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and a regular guest here on this program. He said the Quran explicitly rejects Christianity's central beliefs in the divinity of Jesus and a triune Godhead of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The more we know about Christianity and Islam, the more we see that there is a basic incompatibility, he said. The essential ground of conflict and controversy cannot be removed. One of the representatives of Fuller Theological Seminary says, look, the code is not going to compromise any Christian beliefs. We're asking the faculty, the scholars, the students at Fuller to sign this code of ethics that affirms a belief in one God with Muslims, we worship the same God, and agrees not to proselytize. They say that their belief that Christians, Muslims, and Jews worship the same Creator and God of Abraham is true, but we have different understandings of the divine nature. Okay, let's see if we can sort this out. At Fuller Theological Seminary, they say that Christians, Muslims, and Jews worship the same Creator and God of Abraham, but have different understandings of the divine nature. Like what? The triune nature of God, perhaps? I know that the Jews reject that, and as do the Muslims. The fact that Jesus Christ is God in human flesh. Christians affirm that. The others reject it. But those are minor differences, aren't they? I mean, those are footnotes to the divine nature. We can worship God Creator apart from Redeemer and Sanctifier, can't we? At least at the Fuller Theological Seminary, you can. Monkey see, monkey do. What is Fuller doing? Fuller Theological Seminary is doing what it has been doing for the last 35 years. They've been watching what's going on in the culture and just doing it. If it plays in Peoria, that's all we need to know. What is popular, what sells, is true. Period. Church growth. From Fuller Theological Seminary. Look, this will really clear up a lot of questions for you. Church growth is just liberalism in sheep's clothing. There are no two ways about it, folks. The more I look into it, the more I'm convinced. We did a show recently with Rod Zwanitzer on the future of church growth. They're now talking about a new apostolic and prophetic order in the world, headed by none other than C. Peter Wagner. Theological liberalism in sheep's clothing, the culture calls the shots, and ultimately that means the church follows the culture wherever it leads. And if it leads to saying Muslims and Christians worship the same God, so be it. If it leads to saying that the church really shouldn't be witnessing to Jews and Muslims because we worship the same God, so be it. In fact, we'll do it in the name of church growth, straight out of the heart of Fuller Theological Seminary. And they've got the polls to back them up. Can 56% of the American public be wrong, that Christians, Jews, and Muslims all worship the same God? Apparently not. And the church is reduced just to another little monkey. Monkey see, monkey do. Monkey doesn't have to think much. All he has to know is what works. When he sees it, he does it. It's that simple. I talked before about sitting last night watching Average Joe. It was predictable. Here's this beautiful girl sitting on a red carpet in a airplane hangar. On her right side is a beautiful streamlined jet, fueled up and ready to fly off to some place in the Bahamas or Bimini, I don't know where. On her left side was a bus. Two men arrived in limousines, one average. He made it through the cut of many average Joes, many average guys that had been presented at the beginning of the series for her to weed out and choose from. He'd made the cut. He was the last average Joe standing. Now, midway through the season, they'd introduced a twist in the plot. Into this group of average Joes, guys with pot bellies, guys with less than full heads of hair, their teeth were a little crooked. Some of them were downright ugly, others were passable. Into this group of average Joes, they introduced a group of very good-looking guys. They got into the mix. Now, not surprisingly, the choice for this young lady, she looked like a supermodel. The choice for this one lady came down to the last of the average Joes standing and a guy who looked like he'd walked off the set of a soap opera. He wasn't just good looking, he was pretty. Who would she choose? My wife is saying, she might choose the average Joe. She might choose him. And the whole time I'm thinking, no, she is not going to choose the average Joe. Now, the average Joe was average. He wasn't the best looking guy, but he wasn't terrible looking. But he owned his own business, and he'd made something of himself. He was charming and delightful. The good-looking guy, the other choice, was a waiter someplace with no prospects, except the fact that he was just Hollywood good-looking. Who did she choose? It was so predictable. She chose the good-looking guy. I realize that's what a lot of these shows are about. They're about beautiful people. And one of the latest twists they're putting on the beautiful people shows is, let's see how beautiful people react to less than beautiful people. When worlds collide, the truly beautiful and the average, when they collide, what will happen? Well, it was so predictable because I'd seen it before. I'd seen it before the last time this program was on. The last time it was called Joe Millionaire. Slightly different twists in the plot, but it was the same thing. It was predictable. It suddenly dawned on me, this is why the church today is so predictable. This is why I can walk into any Christian bookstore and I don't have to do much. I don't have to open the books and figure out what's in them anymore. Nobody does. Whatever is most prominently displayed when you walk in, book, tape, makes no difference. That is what the church will be doing. It's predictable. Monkey see, monkey do. Monkey doesn't have to think about the book or the tape. In fact, the monkey's better off if monkey doesn't think about what is in the book or the tape. All monkey needs to know is it's the bestseller. Everybody's using it. It must be good. And a church that said that it could use marketing toward its own ends has instead been used by marketing. Monkey see, monkey do. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 10 minutes for your thoughts, your reactions here on Open Lines. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I can make another prediction because these things are predictable. It has now become almost funny how predictable it is. Stepping completely away from the culture. The smartest people in the culture can actually predict what's going to happen next. And it's not because they have prophetic powers. It's because they know how the system works. It is a system of imitation. It is a system that takes the path of least resistance toward the goal, which is whatever sells. And the church has chosen that path for itself. They're not interested in selling so much as they are in producing results. And they don't really care what kind of results they get as long as they're massive and everyone else is experiencing the same results. That, of course, reinforces that what they are doing must be good and true if everyone else is doing it. If 56% of the people in the United States say that Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God, you feel pretty safe casting your vote with the 56%, don't you? Unless, of course, what 56% of the people in the United States believe is wrong, which is a question that we're simply not asking anymore. Fuller Theological Seminary isn't asking that question anymore. They're not. They have assumed that Christians and Muslims worship the same God, and they've agreed that as part of their latest church growth strategy, coming straight from the think tank of church growth, they're not going to proselytize Muslims anymore. Remember two summers ago when, no, this was three summers ago at least, the Southern Baptists sent 100,000 missionaries to Chicago. And mainline liberal denominations up there objected and said, you can come up here, but you shouldn't be trying to witness to anyone. And they said, well, that's kind of the reason we're coming up. He said, Jesus is the way for us, said the objectors, but it would be arrogant of us to say that Jesus is the way for anyone else. Come on up to Chicago, you 100,000 missionaries, but don't witness to anyone. And people were outraged. And now, Fuller Theological Seminary, that started out as a Bible-believing conservative seminary with church growth tendencies, has decided to follow the path of least resistance to the greatest possible results, to the goal, which is what sells. Monkey see, monkey do. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Anne is calling from Crestwood.
Good afternoon. I think in your discussion today, it makes me think a friend of mine, we're living in a time where people, kids are graduating from high school, but they aren't educated. And people like that will fall for anything less than the truth. They're not concerned with the truth. They're not interested in it. But a friend of mine the other day had a high school girl ask her what state Germany was in. You know, we just shook our head and couldn't, how can you fathom that kind of thinking or less lack of intelligence and lack of education? I was listening to Handel's Messiah the other day. Who makes music like that anymore? You know, it's of a time gone by. And so I'm not brilliant by any means. I think I would not have figured out most of the theology I know today if it were not for you and that radio station. So that's just what I have to say.
Anne, thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know, I would be tempted to lay it all at the doorstep of our education system, but I don't think that's it, really. I've talked about the culture, not the education system. And there are certainly flaws with the kind of education that we get nowadays. Critical thinking is not only not taught, it's discouraged. Have you ever looked through a textbook at the elementary level? Math, science, makes no difference. Number one, it can't stay on one subject for more than half a page. Number two, in a math book, you're more likely to be reading about efforts to save the dolphins or the rainforest than you are about geometry. It is a wonder our children learn anything. It's unbelievable. I remember the textbooks of my youth, and maybe that's just me, but they seemed to kind of have a straightforward approach to the subject. They actually stayed on the subject until they were done with it. And you could read the textbook from page 1 to page 10, first chapter, and actually, if you paid attention, learn something rather than be distracted 15 times in those 10 pages to other subjects. It's a wonder they learn anything. That's a subject for another program. The culture. We are the culture. We're immersed in it. We're not only the product of it, we are the producers of it. Why don't we have the attention span to produce the kind of works of art like Handel's Messiah? Well, I think largely the culture has told us you don't have to. Something that endures is not necessarily useful to us anymore. You see, something that endures bucks the trend of one fad following another. One monkey seeing another monkey doing something and doing the same. When you have something that endures injected into that, it tends to gum up the system. When the driving force behind the culture, politics, and the church is imitation, monkey see, monkey do, don't think about why it works. All you need to know is that it works, and if it's popular and sells, it must be good. You introduce something enduring into that, a truth, a piece of art, an idea that endures into that system, it tends to bog things down. It really does. This explains why the church has abandoned liturgy, because the liturgy endures. You keep the liturgy, it bucks against introducing a new fad every year and a half. When the goal is introducing a new fad every year and a half, anything that endures is going to kind of highlight the transitory nature of those things. And people are going to say, wait a minute, weren't we just doing something a year and a half ago? No. I can't wait until, and really, I'm honest, I can't wait until we get to the point where I'm driving down through St. Louis and I pass a church and one of them is finally honest enough to simply name themselves Monkey See, Monkey Do Church. With the little signboard, it could say, we are like the weather. Stay with us for 24 hours and we'll change, we promise. Mark is calling from his car. Mark, our time runs short. Welcome to
Pastor
Issues Etc.
There's a story in Africa. You take a gourd, a bright, shiny object, put it in the bottom of the gourd. Monkey puts his hand into the gourd to get the bright, shiny object, can't pull his hand out. And he won't let go. If he let go of the object, he could pull his hand out, but he won't let go of the object. So then you've got the monkey. So here's my question to you. What's the bright, shiny object that's so enchanting the church today?
That's an excellent question, Mark. The promise of relevance. And I'm convinced of this. The culture says, if you just reach in and take hold of this, there is relevance sitting at the bottom of the gourd for you. Never let go of it. It is your salvation, O church. Never let go of it. And that's how the culture snares the church. The church reaches in, grabs hold, listens to the culture, and never lets go. And the culture can then tug on the gourd and pull the monkey wherever it wants to go. It's caught. What should the church be looking for rather than the promise of relevance offered by a culture that can never deliver? Maybe something that isn't so bright and shiny. Maybe something that endures. Maybe the gospel of Jesus Christ. We hear all the time, the truth is unchanging, but everything else besides the truth has to continue changing constantly. That denies something. Yes, the truth is unchanging, but the truth of God's word makes other things unchanging too. Everything it touches, everything God's word touches, becomes enduring and eternal and unchanging. Everything. The word of God has a power to transform even us in that way. Oh my goodness, little monkey, aren't you tired of one fad after another? We'll be right back.
Message first, mission second. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In ancient Turkey, in the 4th century, a man named Nicholas lived and preached Christ. Who was Saint Nicholas, and how has his story become attached to the Christmas legend? In our new Issues Etc. book of the month for December, the children's book St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend, you and your children and your grandchildren can travel back to the 4th century and hear the real story of the real St. Nicholas. This children's book, St. Nicholas, costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information on this book, visit our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section. Or you can order St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend by Julie Stiegelmeyer by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A growing number of small towns are getting surprised when high-powered porn peddlers set up shop. The formula the smut business is like is a small town on an interstate highway with unsophisticated zoning laws. Terry Phillips has the story.
Perry, Michigan is an example. Perry has a population of 2,000 people and one adult entertainment outlet, in short, a porn shop. Brad Snavely is executive director of the Michigan Family Forum.
This is not in sync with the values of their community. But often what happens is that after the fact, it's very difficult to undo.
Perry, like most small towns, had only a couple of kinds of zoning. Mayor Steve Daunt says they were looking to update their regulations, but not quickly enough.
This company literally slipped into town and opened up one Sunday evening and just before we could get our ordinance into effect.
Once a porn shop is open, it's difficult to get rid of it, but not impossible. Dan Panetti is an attorney with the National Coalition for the Protection of Children and Families.
The city can come in there and regulate the businesses based on time, place, and manner, and can make it a very difficult process for these establishments to operate.
But the best thing for towns to do is to harden the target by reviewing zoning and ordinances regularly, because a fight against an open porn shop will be costly.
They are extremely well-funded. They want to make a buck. It's up to the community to say, listen, you're not going to make your buck here. Go make your buck somewhere else.
Perry, Michigan's new ordinances went into effect today, but the porn store has gone to court. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
One high-profile case involves Abilene, Kansas, previously best known as the birthplace of President Dwight Eisenhower. Now, a former Stuckey's restaurant has a 60-foot sign along the interstate advertising an adult superstore. In the next 65 miles of I-70, two other stores have opened. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 Thursday on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Diane Irons about age-defying beauty secrets. And Ken Fong will talk to us about Securing God's Embrace. That's his book. It begins at 11:05 Thursday, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our book of the month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. It's the perfect Christmas gift for your young child or grandchild. St. Nicholas is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ed Kettner about the social divide between Canadians and Americans that appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on Friday of last week. It's a story, Cultural Chasm Over Core Values Widens the Canadian-American Social Divide. Then we'll be talking with Dr. Daryl Charles on Just War Theory. He's from Baylor University. He's author of a forthcoming book, The Just War Tradition and Its Contemporary Relevance, and he's also written an article in Touchstone Magazine titled Between Pacifism and Jihad, The Just War Tradition Theory. That's the last half hour of Issues Etc. Before the break, I was talking about the driving force between culture and politics, and now even the church. Monkey see, monkey do. Give this some thought. Do what I recommended at the beginning of that hour. As we were talking about that, just think about this for a while. And suddenly I think it all comes into focus. It begins to answer a lot of questions of why is, I get emails from people who say, why is this happening in my church? Yesterday we got a call from a guy, honestly perplexed. He called from Colorado. Do you remember? He had desired to find a decent Lutheran church and he went to one, and he was disillusioned with it. So they went off and went to a non-denominational evangelical church for a while, and they said, look, we've had enough of this. We're going to go back and give that Lutheran church one more try. We're just sick of the pap and the something different every Sunday that we're getting in the non-denominational church. We're going to give it one more try. He walks in, and at the beginning of the sermon, the pastor fires up a chainsaw and does a sermon on removing the rough corners of your life and ties it into their building program. And he said, how do these guys get away with this? Why is this happening in my church? What is going on? We did the purpose-driven life review with the panel of pastors. Almost a month and a half ago now. Every day, and I'm not kidding, I'm not exaggerating, every day I get an email from someone who's listened to that, who says, this happened in our church, it's going to happen in our church, or why is this happening in my church? Monkey see, monkey do. If everyone else is doing it, it must be good. Monkey just sees and does. I want to talk to the monkeys for just a second. Aren't you tired of a different fad every year and a half? Fads that when they come promise so much, but when they have left, leave you hungrier and thirstier than you were at the beginning? Fads that promise something, and then when they leave, you realize, you know, it just wasn't everything it was supposed to be. Fads that distract your congregation from the preaching of Christ and Him crucified. Fads that teach your church, your children, that church is pretty much like watching television. This season it'll be this thing, next season it'll be the next thing. And there's always a next thing, always another thing around the corner. Fad after fad and program after program, all promising, all leaving you empty-handed. Are you tired of it? Someone called before the break, talked about the little monkey who trapped the little monkey. He can reach into the bottom of the gourd to try and get the shiny thing out, and he won't let go of it, and so you've got the monkey. Let go. Let go of the shiny false promise of relevance. And take hold of the thing that endures, that doesn't come this season and leave next season, that doesn't change every year and a half, that doesn't promise and leave you empty-handed, that doesn't leave you more hungry and more thirsty than you were before. It's not sexy. It doesn't sell well. It will not receive the acclaim of the New York Times bestsellers list. In fact, it's what the church has been offering and giving from the very beginning, without fanfare. The pure word of God, the gospel of Jesus Christ, unadorned, because it doesn't need any adorning. Unacclaimed, because it does its own work. When it touches people's lives, it creates out of little monkeys who are constantly chasing the next thing, simply seeing and doing, creates full-grown human beings who not only can discern truth from error and fads and fiction from things that endure, but are themselves transformed to be enduring. Hold fast to what Paul said in the end was the only thing he had to offer the Corinthians, who'd seen every fad the Greek world had to offer. Christ and Him crucified, Jesus, the sacrifice for sinners, resurrected from the dead, the forgiveness of sins and life and salvation in His name. Little monkey, don't let anyone tell you that there's got to be more to it than that. Anything more is something less. Anything more than Jesus is something less than Jesus. It's all the church has ever needed. I know it sounds radical. I know it goes against the popular mentality. I know that it is spoken against. I know that it is contrary to conventional wisdom. And all of the marketing gurus who promised that we could use marketing in the church and rather have turned around and used the church for marketing. But that's all the church will ever need. Christ and Him crucified for sinners. As the Christmas season approaches, there is something that your children might want to know. Who is the real St. Nicholas? They might ask you this question. Do you have an answer for it? We have the answer in our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December. It's called St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. It tells the simple story, what can be known, of the genuine historical figure, St. Nicholas. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. You can also visit one of Concordia Publishing House's locations, either here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton or at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. When you call or write or go in, make sure you mention Issues Etc. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ed Kettner, Academic Dean and Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Recently, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, under the heading Focus on Canada, the headline reads, Cultural Chasm Over Core Values Widens the Canadian-American Social Divide. There does appear to be a widening gap. We're going to talk about it for the next 25 minutes. Dr. Ed Kettner, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Nice of you to have me.
Is it something that you sense on your side of our northern border, a growing chasm socially, morally, philosophically between you, our northern neighbors, and we Americans?
Well, I'm tempted to say don't believe everything you read in the papers. But there is some difference, yeah. But I think that a lot of the play of the differences in terms of the grassroots people is a little bit overrated, frankly.
Tell us about Canada as a nation. It is not only something that seldom appears on Americans. We are so narcissistic, it seldom appears on our radar screen. But it is something that when we hear the news, like you say, it is often either overplayed or sounds worse
right.
than it perhaps is. Tell us about Canada as a nation.
Well, the article, I've got the article here on my, that you're referring to on my computer screen at the moment, and I've just been reading it over for the last little while. And the fact that Canada came into being by a much more sedate process than revolution is one of the hallmarks of Canadian identity, I think. Canadian identity still sees itself in some ways as part of the British Commonwealth. We still recognize the Queen of England as the Queen of Canada, and she is officially the head of state represented by the Governor General. Though Canada, for the last generation or so, has had its own constitution and has its own Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is where some of this controversy comes in. It is a parliamentary government. It does not have the system of checks and balances in the same way that the United States does, with three branches of government. There are two. There's Parliament and there are the courts. And because it doesn't have the check of a separate executive, the party that is in control in Parliament basically runs the show. Though, with the introduction of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the courts are coming more and more into running the show as well, too, as witness the events in British Columbia first, and then followed up a short time later in Ontario, just in this past year, with the declaration that forbidding homosexual marriage is a violation of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. That's where some of this big controversy comes in, because Canada has basically been told by the courts, you must pass legislation regulating marriage in a way which does not forbid homosexual marriage. So, but then we can say, well, also in the states, the state of Massachusetts just recently ruled the same thing. So it's not all that different in some of the court's jurisdictions.
Now, part of the misconception might lie in the fact that we tend to think of Canada as just one big country rather than a system of provinces.
Right. It is... sometimes it's said that Canada can't quite figure out what it is. Is it a nation or is it basically a confederation of provinces? And every once in a while you'll get talk about Western dissatisfaction because the majority of the population lies in Ontario and Quebec. with a substantial portion in B.C., and sometimes it seems that the three prairie provinces, of which I live in one, sometimes get left out of the equation. That, in a way, is a little a bit of the problem as well, too. The prairie provinces tend to be socially rather conservative, Alberta particularly.
Let's talk about some of the survey results that were featured in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch story, beginning with the issue of what comprises kind of a healthy, satisfying family. Canada is polled as 66% saying that both spouses hold jobs, share the household and child care duties, whereas 16% say the husband is the sole support of the family.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., similar but to a slightly different degree, 58% hold the first opinion, 26%, a full quarter, hold the opinion that the family is better if comprised with the husband as the sole support of the family.
Uh-huh.
Do you think this reflects the attitudes of Canadians?
I think it's pretty fair to say so. I think that does pretty well state it. It's not all that different. I suppose in some of the so-called social issues, Canada would be seen as a little bit more on the liberal side. That, I think, doesn't change the fact that there are still a very significant number of people that hold to what we would call the Christian values. I'm not a great fan of that particular term because those values aren't necessarily Christian, but belong to the realm of what we might consider natural law.
On the issue of homosexuality, whether it should be accepted by society, the gap does appear to widen, at least according to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly over a quarter of Canadians say that homosexuality should not be accepted, with the balance saying it should, whereas in the U.S. it seems to be split a little more 50-50.
Yeah.
51% of Americans say that it should be accepted, only 42% say no. How do we account for this this difference between these two neighboring nations?
I really can't tell you, because we both very much rely on the same media. U.S. media is very prevalent in Canada. Vast majority of Canadians have cable TV, which receive at least some of the network U.S. Television stations, and so we're very well aware of what's going on in the States. It's very difficult for me, actually, to say why that's the case. Part of it, and I think that does vary. I don't know if there's been a change in the educational system in recent years that's been pushing that. Some might put the responsibility for it on that. In a way, I'm a little bit of a loss to say for that, because though I'm interested in popular culture and movement in the culture, that's not my major area of expertise.
Let's go to the phones at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues Etc.
I have two questions. I've heard that it's illegal for a citizen of Canada to say essentially in a public forum homosexuality is wicked, that it's illegal to say that, and you don't have those free speech rights. Secondly, in St. Louis, we can tune into about 10 Christian stations, and someone said, and I don't know if it's true, in Canada there is no Christian radio. So those are my two questions.
Thank you very much, Kurt. That's two excellent questions. First of all, about it being, is it true that it's illegal to call homosexuality a sin in public?
No, it is not. Though there's some controversy about a bill, let me quickly bring it up on my computer screen here, that one very notorious openly homosexual member of parliament has been trying to push. There are laws on the books regarding so-called hate literature, which were passed a decade or so ago, but which do not relate to sexual orientation. There is an attempt going on right now to put that on the books, always with the assurance, well, that won't outlaw certain religious literature in that regard. And they say nobody's going to say you can't in your own religion say that homosexuality is wrong. But the way things are being phrased, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that at some point, if this particular member of parliament gets his way, that even saying homosexuality is wrong would constitute a hate crime. It is true that in Saskatchewan, the Board for Human Rights censured a man and fined him, I think, $5,000 for publishing an ad in the paper which basically quoted the Bible passages which said homosexuality is wrong. So that may be what you're referring to. And but that's not law, that's bureaucracy. And that's the further demonstration. The bureaucrats can sometimes be more dangerous than the lawmakers can.
And to his second question about Christian broadcasts in Canada?
It's not true. There are Christian radio stations. We've got a very nice one here in Edmonton that plays Christian music. Christian radio programs abound on those stations. It's true that up until very recently, there were no Christian TV stations. But now there are certain micro-broadcasters, and there are isolated Christian television stations around as well. And there is on cable TV a station known as Vision TV, which is a quote-unquote religious or spiritual cable station, which shows Christian programming along with programming from a variety of other religious perspectives. And you do get some solid conservative Christian programming on that particular station. In fact, some of the Lutheran television programs have been on there from time to time as well.
Mike is calling from Canada, listening on the Internet. Mike, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for taking my call. And Dr. Kettner is actually a former professor of mine.
This is the Mike that I thought it was.
Yes.
Good to talk with you, Mike.
Yes. Well, the reason why, the question that I have is, I know in the United States, evangelicalism, being maybe your Baptists and non-denominationals and Pentecostal churches, are far more prevalent throughout the United States than they are in Canada, whereas, you know, in Canada we are maybe more of the mainline churches are more prominent. Do you see that as having a major influence upon the societies that we live in?
Excellent question, Mike.
Yeah, I think so. Though it is interesting, let me call up another site here. I'm quoting from a review now of Reginald Bibby's most recent book. Reg Bibby is a sociologist from the University of Lethbridge, which is one of the major universities here in Alberta. He's well known in Canada as a sociologist. But what he is saying is that Canada's supposed abandonment of the Christian faith is simply not real, not true. It's true, church attendance is down. But he says, while 20% of Canadians currently attend religious services every week, another 58% attend at least once a year. And since the 1950s, weekly attendance at conservative Protestant or evangelical churches has increased from 700,000 to 1.5 million. That's more than 100% increase in that regard. So there is not quite as large an evangelical movement in Canada as there is in the States. And maybe that's one of the reasons why Canada is moving a little bit further in toward the left sociologically, because it doesn't have quite that. And sometimes it seems that the evangelicals find themselves marginalized. There was a comment in the Post-Dispatch article, I believe, that said that anybody right of center in Canada is always looked upon a little bit strange. And I don't think that's the case. Part of the problem is that the conservative movement in Canada has been divided, but just within the last week, the two right-of-center parties, political parties in Canada, have just united, and that seems to have the more liberal government that's currently in power running scared a little bit. I find that quite intriguing.
Dr. Kettner, how much pressure is there on denominational churches in Canada to downplay their denominational character or their affiliation, like the pressure of non-denominational churches here in America?
It is there. And there are even the occasional Lutheran churches that are buying into some of the neo-evangelical style. But I think for the most part, we still desire to maintain a very strong confessional identity. And you do have that. There are conservative Christians of a number of different stripes in Canada and all the major cities and in the rural areas as well, too. But they do, it seems, pretty well define themselves on the basis of some sort of denominational affiliation.
Larry is calling from his car. Larry, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes. Thank you. I have two questions, actually. I've been blessed as a Christian man here in the States who struggled with the sin of homosexuality. I was blessed to find help through support groups like the Living Waters Program, Exodus International. My questions would be, one, in Canada, what are these kinds of support groups available to Christian men and women who struggle with this sin and brokenness? And what kind of literature or materials are available for pastors and lay people to help minister to Christian men and women who struggle with this?
Two good questions. We've got about, about 2 minutes, no more, to respond.
Okay. The items are there. I don't think they're as well publicized in Canada, but those support groups are there in Canadian cities as well as in the States. And the literature is there. But again, I don't see it as well publicized as it is in some circles in the States. Those groups are most certainly there, and that literature most certainly is there.
With only a few seconds here, Dr. Kettner, how much pressure is there on the church in Canada to compromise with the culture?
Oh, it's always there. But I constantly tell my students that we need to see ourselves as countercultural subversives in a lot of ways, and recognizing that sometimes direct frontal attacks on the basis of the law don't work, because all the law does is accuse, and St. Paul says it increases the trespass. What we need to do is show God's love for the sinner, not in affirming the sinner in his or her sin, but in affirming them as people for whom Christ died. And so while the temptation is always there to wimp out and to pat people on the head and say, God loves you just like you are, a true gospel presentation will say, God forgives you. God receives you as you are, and he forgives you. And I think that's where the task of the church really lies.
Dr. Ed Kettner, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ed Kettner is academic dean and professor of systematic theology at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. When we come back from this break, just war theory. Just because the war is, well, at least in theory, over, and just because it seems to be also at the same time dragging on interminably, doesn't mean that there's not an opportunity for us in the last half hour of Issues Etc. to revisit what it is the church has taught traditionally on war, on the need for it, and the morality of it. Just war theory is the subject. When we come back, Dr. Daryl Charles of Baylor University will be our guest.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.